Neuro-oncology is an amazing blend of clinical patient care, along with research, scientific advancement, and the opportunity to really advance patient care. It's an amazing blend because you get to see patients and you really get to have the privilege of navigating through very serious illness, very serious conversations.
Welcome back to the Neurophilia Podcast. If this is your first time listening or you are a frequent listener, we want to thank you for taking some time out of your day to learn more about the wonderful world of neurology. Neurophilia is an atypical medical podcast show focused on dispelling neurophobia one conversation at a time. We are your hosts, Dr. Nuper Goyle and Dr. Blake Bilecko. In this episode, we will be discussing the subspecialty of neuro-oncology with the one and only Dr. Joshua Badu. Dr. Joshua Badu is a neuro-oncologist and the inaugural Nicole's Biondi Diversity Clinical Scientist Faculty Scholar at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. He is a health equity scholar and develops interventions to improve access to care and mitigate health disparities. Dr. Badu is also the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Section Editor for Neurology. Dr. Badu, welcome to the Neurophilia Podcast. Dr. Bilecko and I are thrilled to have you here to represent the subspecialty of neuro-oncology.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate you inviting me on the show.
Before we dive into neuro-oncology, we would love to hear more about you and your career thus far. Can you walk us through your journey to medicine and neurology?
Yeah, I'm definitely happy to. And I'll say that my kind of backstory into neurology and medicine in general, it's a bit tragic. It's a tragic incident that kind of really galvanized me to consider medicine as a profession. And the event happened when I was a sophomore in college. So I was 19 at the time. My eldest brother, Ravi, actually passed away. So the kind of events around that were really what led me to my work, which is really in social determinants of health and medicine, as well as just trying to care for underserved populations. A bit kind of about the story. So, this was actually in June of 2008. He didn't come home one night. So I remember my mom and dad, they were both calling around local hospitals or calling around his friends, seeing if like where had he been. So we hadn't heard from him about 24 hours. And then a day later, we were able to find out that he had actually was driving home drunk, ended up hitting a parked car. He didn't hurt anyone. When the police found him, he was awake, he was conscious, he was responding, but he had a few scrapes. So they ended up taking him to one of the local public hospitals. Because he was driving drunk, they handcuffed him, actually never arraigned him. So when we were able to see him about a day later, he was handcuffed in a bed, both hands and feet. And he was conscious. He was talking to us, like wanting to like go home. And we thought it would be kind of a quick hospital stay. But over the next few days, he started to get a bit worse. Developed a fever, and on like day four, when we actually came to the hospital, we saw that he was his breathing was irregular, and they had intubated him actually without telling any of us. I remember trying to talk to the nurses and the doctors, and there's some moments that are kind of crystallized in your life, and I remember this moment exactly because we were Guyanese immigrants. We were in a hospital that wasn't well funded, and I was trying to speak with the physician there. They said they didn't have any time to speak with family members. And when one of the nurses came and said, "You know why he's here in the hospital?" Because we had asked like, "Why is he here? Like, can he go home?" And they just said he has a drinking problem. So a little bit of backstory about my brother. He was an immigrant from Guyana, came here when he was six. Went to the local public schools around our house, and my family, we didn't really have many resources. So he was unable to go to college, had to work immediately afterwards. Actually did pretty well for himself, was able to start his own IT company, but then lost all of his money in like the tech bubble of the early 2000s, 2001. Had to move back in. He became depressed, started drinking heavily, gained a lot of weight, was ended up actually being diabetic. And all of these kind of factors altogether kind of led up to this incident. So when we asked that, you know, specific night, why was he here? His entire life story was put into one sentence. He's here because he has a drinking problem. Over the next 2 days, we were reassured by the staff over and over that he was going to be fine, that he was doing well. And then on that Sunday, which was actually Father's Day, we got a call saying that we should, you know, come into the hospital soon. So we went to the police precinct because he wasn't arraigned and he was still in police custody. We actually had to get a pass every time that we wanted to see him. I remember the police captain there holding us up for about 2 hours, saying that we could not see him. So they actually didn't give us a pass to see him. And once we finally got a pass, then we drove to the hospital. By the time we got there, he had passed away. He had died from a pulmonary embolus, a blood clot that had developed from him being sedated, both chemically as well as physically restrained, and staying in a hospital bed for 6 straight days. And I always thought that was kind of the entire situation, you know, the aftermath of it. I was like, he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. If he didn't hit that parked car, if he, you know, wasn't in that, you know, that if they didn't take him to that hospital, everything could have been avoided. But then I started to learn about, you know, what are the other factors that go into healthcare and like and into this incident. And that's when I learned about the social determinants of health. And I realized, you know, we were immigrants. We lived in an area that was a food desert. We didn't have many resources. He was on Medicaid. We went to a public hospital. He was brought in by the police, which has its own set of biases. We had no one in the medical field. We didn't even know, you know, what to ask, like who to advocate for us. And we kind of implicitly trusted the system. And that's when I kind of realized that it wasn't necessarily some one-off tragic event, but it was almost a probability. And, you know, given different circumstances, it just as well could have been me in his situation. And that was the event, the impetus for me to really go into medicine. And I came in with a goal and determination to make sure that every single person gets the best care that they can. And a real big part of that is focusing on social determinants of health, the conditions in which we age, we live, we work, we play. And these are the other factors that really go into, you know, our overall health. And that's what got me started in health equity. And I eventually matriculated at Morehouse School of Medicine. That's a school that's a historically Black university, and I chose to go there because they were actually the top school for social mission. They focused on underserved populations, focused on Medicaid populations, as well as like minorities and other marginalized populations in the U.S. And they gave me kind of the grounding as well as the kind of initial training for me to kind of take this work into neurology and actually kind of what I do right now. So that's kind of the story about how I got into medicine. You know, after this entire episode, I thought I would be like a primary care provider. I thought I'd either be a pediatrician or family physician, and then I would kind of go back to Queens or some underserved neighborhood and kind of like be the community doctor. But while I was in medical school, I realized that I started to really like the like brain, both central and peripheral nervous system. And I started to actually think about maybe a career in, you know, neuro something would be appropriate. Because Morehouse is a smaller school, we actually didn't have a neurology clerkship. So I had to try to get, you know, training elsewhere. Ended up rotating at University of Washington, Mount Sinai in New York, Mass General in Boston, and Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York. And these were all kind of experiences that I did through like the visiting elective program. And it was a really wonderful experience because I got to see neurology practice in like in different areas of the country. And everyone just had, well, one thing about neurology, everyone was just friendly. And you got to see the different aspects about how, like in on the West Coast, it was so much more laid back, and then when it came back to the East Coast, everyone was like shirt and tie. But the biggest thing that I realized was that, you know, the thing that I loved the most about neurology was just the time that people spent with their patients. And part of that is the physical exam, it's the history. And it just seemed like the one specialty that was just so comprehensive. And, you know, so loving like the subject matter, but then just the interaction with the patients was just unparalleled. So that kind of led me to neuro. Met a really like some really nice people all throughout the kind of my like visiting rotations. And at MGH, that's actually where I met a couple of mentors who actually are still lifelong mentors for me. And they encouraged me to train there and ended up applying, ended up matching there. You know, it was such a great kind of academic environment. You have all of these teachers, people from like the, you know, experts in the field. And it was just great to like analyze every single case and like just spend time with patients. And when I think back to like neuro-oncology, for a neuro-oncologist, you know, that time with patients is just also so valuable as well, just because of how serious the diseases are that we take care of, the kind of relationships you build, not only with your patients, but with your families. And that really kind of drew me to that specialty. And after spending some time at MGH on our neuro-oncology inpatient service, you know, spending time outpatient, I really realized that the working with cancer patients, specifically brain cancer patients, was something that I really, really wanted to do. And that kind of drove me into the specialty. At the same time, I kept trying to figure out how do I meld my, you know, my passion for health equity with neuro-oncology, because it kept, for me, it kept feeling that every step of the way, I was like, okay, now I'm going to be like a subspecialist. Now I'm going to be even a more subspecialist. And is that really the right thing to do if I'm going for health equity? And then I kind of realized along the way that, you know, health equity is not a zero-sum game. And sometimes these smaller specialties or these like in which the patient populations may not be large, these are the areas in which patients actually need the most in terms of resources and making sure that people are looking out for their, you know, their own like social situations and kind of really advocating for them. And so from that, I was able to kind of combine both of my passions and where I research disparities in neuro-oncology, so both neurology, oncology, as well as like brain tumor specific. And I'm implementing kind of health equity interventions that really help our patients who are at risk for financial toxicity, for food insecurity. And it's been really rewarding so far just to see the just the difference that some interventions can have.
Josh, I just want to say how humbled we are to be able to hear about such a vulnerable and transformative experience in your life and the lives of those you love, and how it has influenced the way that you view medicine and the way that you provide care for your patients. So thank you for telling us about the story and how it has influenced you thus far.
Obviously, you've provided us with sort of the reason for why you love the field, but we would also love to hear the additional training that it takes after neurology residency to then become a neuro-oncologist.
Yeah. So neuro-oncology is a like a fellowship training. So there's actually a couple paths you can take. So there are medical oncologists who are neuro-oncologists as well. So you can do an internal medicine residency, then a medical oncology fellowship, and then a neuro-oncology fellowship. For neurologists like us, you do your neurology residency followed by a neuro-oncology fellowship. That can last anywhere from 1 to 3 or even more years. Most programs have at least 1 year of really heavy clinical training, and the programs that have additional years are usually there for research or in my case, I was actually able to do like a second fellowship. So the training time itself usually adds about 1 to 2 years on top of your neurology residency training. There are a decent amount of programs for neuro-oncology. We run on a match system. So it's before it used to be kind of like the the exploding offers where every year it seemed like another program was interviewing people a month earlier to try to to really get candidates to come there. But now we have like a more formal process, and it's it's a pretty small field as well. There, I think there are only about 300 board certified neuro-oncologists in the country. So there's actually our annual meeting is going on now as well. Everyone's friendly, and it's an awesome, excellent field to be in.
Josh, I have a couple of questions. One is just, I'll start with a statement. I think you might be the first person in a long time that you said something very early on in your journey that I just don't hear a lot. And that's how much you love the central and the peripheral nervous system. You said that, and I was like, this is not, this is someone who is a true neurologist. Love all of it. And I think that that's pretty special and cool. So one of my questions, whenever you were kind of talking us through the different pathways into this, was what's the current split estimate of how many people within the field are neurologists versus people that came in through medicine? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, so the majority are neurology trained. So I'd say like estimate maybe like 80% or even more. At a lot of centers, like neuro-oncologists can be placed into different departments. So at Memorial Sloan Kettering, for example, we're under the Department of Neurology. But at UCSF, for example, they're under the Department of Neurosurgery. And at other places, they're under the Department of like Medical Oncology. So it just depends where it is. But a neurologist usually is the kind of the backbone of training for neuro-onc.
And then I guess a quick follow-up, maybe a little bit related and a little bit not, but that can propel us into some more conversation is, you know, you talked about, you know, wanting to hold on to being a neurologist and taking care of the whole patient. And I think in academic medicine, not just neurology, we are seeing that everybody is becoming so subspecialized and so niche in what they do. And one of my questions for you is, are you seeing this a lot within neuro-oncology to where not only in neuro-oncology as a subspecialty, is it a small field, but then are people within neuro-oncology also then subspecializing in different types of tumors, treatments, metastatic disease versus primary? What's the subspecialization look like within neuro-oncology?
Yeah, so that's a really, really, really good question, Blake. And I'd say it varies center to center. So for example, in Memorial Sloan Kettering, we have 20 neuro-oncologists, and people can become very, very subspecialized. They only see one particular tumor. Like for example, one person only sees CNS lymphoma, which is a rare disease by itself, but there's enough of a volume for someone to specialize in that. But as a lot of, if we look kind of around the country though, in some states there are just one neuro-oncologist or there might be zero. Neuro-oncology is pretty broad. So there's central nervous system tumors that range from primary brain tumors to brain mets. Then there's kind of all the complications that you can have from cancer, paraneoplastic syndromes. There's the medical complications, which can be like DVTs and like PEs, strokes, like hemorrhages, as well as kind of the neurologic complications of chemotherapy. There's the neurocutaneous syndromes like neurofibromatosis, and the spectrum actually is quite broad. And there are a lot of people who see all of it because depending where they practice, they might be the only person there who can actually provide advanced like subspecialization or at least some type of expertise in these syndromes. Now, I will say that even though like people can become really subspecialized, we do, you know, I consider myself a neurologist first. So even thinking about clinic, so my clinic today, I actually saw a couple of people for migraines. I saw a couple of peripheral, chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, as well as a couple of primary brain tumors and brain metastasis. So there's like a wide gamut of what we see. And for example, at Memorial Sloan Kettering, we have a very strong neurology history. So we kind of pride ourselves on being able to, you know, staff our neurology patients and to be able to not necessarily need to refer out to a specialist unless they would really benefit from that type of care.
I think that's something that I've always recognized and admired about neuro-oncologists is one, I feel like you all retain your medical, kind of your internal medicine knowledge a lot better than the rest of us. And the other part is that you really do as subspecialized as you get have to be comfortable with a lot of other subspecialties in neurology. I mean, I was just thinking through what you had said, and I see so many patients that have a either a primary brain tumor or metastatic disease that are dealing with seizures, or on a surveillance MRI, we see that there's new stroke and they get either referred or they get managed all within neuro-oncology until someone becomes a little bit more complicated. And then you have all these kind of therapies now that are all leading to different kind of adverse events that can affect the nervous system, but other systemic disease as well. And so I feel, and I've admired my neuro-oncology colleagues for how much that they can really take care of the patient. And it seems like maybe there's a little less kind of referring out to this person and that person and that person. You feel really comfortable with the whole patient. So I've also noticed that, and I admire that about the field and people that are within neuro-oncology.
Yeah. And I think a big part of that is usually when we kind of assume care as a neuro-oncologist, because a lot of the diseases we take care of are very serious. You sometimes become their primary care or like physician going forward, and you take care of everything. You're the point of first contact. You're the one that dealing with all like the ancillary services, like physical therapy, occupational therapy, making sure that quality of life is good. And, you know, they come to you with every single problem. And a lot of times for, especially my primary patients, I see them once a month or even more often, depending on how like things are going. And even if we're not seeing each other, you know, the nurses check in like weekly, basically, just to make sure like things are going well. So you really become involved in all aspects of their care. And it's, you know, the other part of it, which I really, really love, is that you get to know the patient really well. You get to know their families really well. And you really, really build like a connection that is just, in my mind, it's what makes the field really great.
Yeah, I was, a little bit curious to talk to you a little bit about within neuro-oncology. It seems like the field attracts a lot of physician scientists and people that have a lot of research interest. Certainly, there's a lot of people doing really great clinical care from a neuro-oncology standpoint, but most people that I run into have a little bit of a passion for research. Could you comment on that specifically within neuro-oncology and why this is such a popular pathway into a physician scientist kind of subspecialty?
Yeah. And it's, it kind of almost goes back to the fellowship training where, you know, that's 1 year clinical, but then multiple years of either doing research or some type of other project, whether it's like clinical research or laboratory bench research or like patient reported outcomes or health services research. And I think the way that for me too, and like I kind of like blend my time, is that while it's really rewarding to work with patients who are very sick, it can also be very emotionally taxing, and sometimes you need that kind of recharge. And I think a lot of us like to blend our both research interest and passion to try and make better cures, better treatments, and just better quality of life for patients along with the patient care, because it allows us to, you know, to be able to deal and kind of emotionally recharge after a lot of those difficult patient encounters, or if someone is not doing so well. And so that's kind of like the I think almost the practical part of it. The other aspect is that neuro-oncology is still in its infancy, I think, in terms of treatments for patients. So, the mainstays are like neurosurgery, radiation, and like chemotherapy. But there are so many other things we're studying, targeted therapies. We're studying so many immunotherapies like vaccines, different types of viruses that we can use to really try to, you know, manipulate the tumor environment. Given, some of the conditions we see, like glioblastoma, in which, honestly, we haven't had like an FDA approved treatment that extends lifespan and all been over like basically 20 years. A lot of us really recognize the urgency that we need to find better treatments for our patients. So I think that's what really draws a lot of the like clinical scientists running clinical trials, and as well as just trying to understand the tumor environment better at the bench. And that's like a reason why we, it's very research heavy at times, because we really are trying to find what is the next best thing that we can offer our patients.
I'm going to have Newbert cut me off because everything that we start talking about, I think of two more questions after the fact. So I feel like I could sit here and chat about a lot of different things for days, but I'll let Newbert kind of take back over and get us on track.
This is a great conversation, and I just have a few more questions to ask. Josh, you mentioned that as a neuro-oncologist, you often act as the primary care provider for your patients. We were wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the collaboration you have with different medical specialties. So who are you often collaborating with? If you can talk a little bit about that aspect of your job.
Yeah, and so that's a really, really good question. Because as neuro-oncologists, we don't operate in a vacuum. We have a lot of people who we work together with. And, you know, when take, for example, like a new diagnosis of a glioblastoma, a patient usually sees the neurosurgeon first, can see us afterwards, they see the radiation oncologist. And we work closely together with those specialties, also with neuroradiologists, a pathologist, as well as actually some of our researchers as well. So I kind of think back to our tumor board, which we have every week, and seeing which specialties are represented there. So sometimes there's medical oncology, there's always us, there's always neurosurgery or a surgeon represented, always radiation specialist, always radiologist, neuroradiologist, as well as neuropath as well. It's also, one of the fields in which we can also see neuropathology all the time. And we have, the slides in front of us. We have kind of integrated diagnosis, which is a kind of really evolved the field, which we look at tumor profiling, all these other things, which is also part of the research, which is, has really helped us to understand tumors better. That's kind of the immediate environment. And then as a neuro-oncologist, especially working for a cancer hospital, I personally work a lot with the thoracic and medical oncologists. So I see a lot of lung cancer patients who have brain metastasis. So I actually sit right next to the thoracic oncologist on Friday, and we kind of work together actually in a multidisciplinary clinic where they see the thoracic oncologist, then they go right next door 20 feet to see me, and we kind of try to meld like the patient visits. It's really a multidisciplinary care that we offer.
That's excellent. And then you've already briefly talked about sort of the patients that you've seen today alone in clinic, but if you could talk a little bit more about the day in the life or the week in the life of a neuro-oncologist, that would be great.
Yeah, and I'll kind of break it down based on kind of my schedule. So I see patients 2 days a week. These are like clinical days, and my practice varies from brain metastasis patients to primary patients. So these are gliomas, which can go from like low-grade gliomas all the way to glioblastoma. But then I also see the neurologic complications. And, we are the neurologist for the hospital. So if someone, has a migraine, someone, there are a few patients who I've seen who have neuromyelitis optica that we diagnose kind of paraneoplastic autoimmune syndromes in. They want to continue following up with us, so I'm treating their autoimmune conditions as well. If I feel overwhelmed, I do refer out, and there are neuroimmunologists across the street from us. So I see the patients twice a week, 2 days a week, and then the rest of my week is based basically doing my research and my kind of advocacy work. So. These are running clinical trials for health equity. Other neuro-oncologists usually run clinical trials for basically medications or like drugs that we're trying out. And there are some neuro-oncologists at our institution who, when they're not seeing patients, are in the lab. So they're at the bench. They're looking at other ways in which we can either classify tumors or figure out, is there like a mechanism for drug delivery? Like there's so many other things that they can do. Another aspect, which I really like about our kind of field, is the heavy emphasis on teaching. So I work closely with residents, fellows, the medical oncology fellows as well, and actually the medicine interns and like the medical students. So there's like we actually have a huge team on our consult service. There's like at least always 10 plus people. So whenever we're kind of on our inpatient service, it's a big teaching environment. And Mondays is kind of our department academic day. So we have lots of meetings. We have our tumor boards. on my tumor boards, there's primary tumor board, there's neurofibromatosis tumor board, there's brain mets tumor board, there's SRS tumor board, there's spine tumor board. So depending on your interest or the type of patients you see, there are many ways that you can really collaborate and be a part of it. So kind of to sum up, you know, a mix of clinical, a mix of research, and then a mix of just academic teaching, learning, and also trying to understand our patients better.
You know, I don't practice any outpatient, obviously, neuro-oncology, but I rotate in our general inpatient service a lot. And I see the acute phase of neuro-oncology and trying to get to a diagnosis because, you know, that time is of the essence. And I also recognize that taking tissue from the brain is not, or the spine or anywhere, is not always the first thing that people want to jump to. And so we have this kind of labor intensive process to do diligence to make sure that we are working a patient up appropriately and making sure that we're not thinking that this is something else. But there's a lot of times that we go to tumor board, and thank goodness for the neuro-oncologists, because they always have this stamp of let's get some tissue and get things moving. Do you find this where you're at in an oncology hospital specifically, that there's still this delay of trying to get some tissue diagnosis? And do you ever think that it impacts the patients, or do you think that taking this slow delayed approach of some sort is the better route from a due diligence standpoint to make sure that we're not missing something else? It seems like this tissue diagnosis, whenever it comes to brain biopsies, is always a sticky subject for this multidisciplinary team. So I just was curious to see what your take was on that.
So as oncologists, we have the saying, tissue is the issue. So we are definitely advocates for, especially if it's appropriate, for early diagnosis. If something looks like a tumor, like the faster we can diagnose it, the faster we can figure out what it is and treat it. Being at an oncology institution, we are much quicker to biopsy, much quicker to resect, and that's just kind of the nature of it. The kind of question though about like taking the targeted approach too, and I think that comes to some of our research in which we are looking at ways that we can do, like, are there like liquid biopsies that we can do, or like biomarker testing? So for example, looking at CSF, can we see tumor markers that may actually be indicative of this person has a glioma or so? And actually in the past couple of years, we've, in a question which, you know, we were wondering, is it this an autoimmune disease versus like, is this an atypical presentation of a, you know, some type of primary brain tumor? We've actually used CSF sampling to find actually tumor markers based on it, and actually gone under surgery for that. So I'm actually hopeful that the field is going to evolve too as some of this technology comes out, because there's been recent publications about I'm using this like cell-free DNA CSF sampling about, you know, maybe in the next 5-10 years we can do this actually, or make a diagnosis much easier than a brain biopsy or a section. I will also say, like, as a plug too for brain biopsy or resection, patients usually actually do well. And for our patients who come in for a resection, we have a 48-hour basically time period where they come in, they get their surgery, and we expect them to be discharged within 48 hours home ambulatory walking, unless there's some other kind of complication. So I think if you're a streamlined at an institution that is very comfortable with resection and biopsy, then totally feasible.
Great, thanks.
I was wondering if you could talk us through some of the specific challenges of the field of neuro-oncology compared to other subspecialties within neurology.
Yeah, and so I think that goes back to, actually, it's a double-edged sword why I like the field so much, in which there are a lot of serious conversations, there are a lot of serious illness that we deal with, which can make it challenging at times. You know, it's a lot of our patients end up, unfortunately, passing away. And it can be, and in terms of kind of the treatments we offer, can offer them, sometimes they're not the best treatments. There can be toxic, efficacy might not be that good. And, you know, in terms of like balancing quantity of life versus quality of life, we have to make a lot of hard decisions. And I think that can be the most challenging thing to like really deal with. And it comes really into the art of medicine, because there's no like pathway that's like going to show you that, you know, the quality of life for this patient, given their values, like where does that like come in? And so I think it can be pretty challenging compared to, you know, if you just were able to kind of go down a list. And sometimes my days would definitely be easier if I could just say, you know, here's box A, here's box B, and then, or this is our next step. But at every kind of scan and every treatment decision or kind of fork in the road, we kind of have to take a look back. And I think that can be the most challenging part of the profession, but at the same part, double-edged sword, because I think it's such a privilege to be able to counsel people and to really try to understand them. I get to know their values and figure out, you know, what's right for one patient might not be right for the other.
A conversation that we had when we interviewed some people who are experts in palliative medicine, and neurology and palliative medicine kind of have the label of sometimes being depressing and, you know, devoid of hope. And I feel like, especially for neuro-oncology, as you mentioned, there's a lot of very sad cases that you have to, you know, oftentimes manage as a provider. And so I'm wondering, how do you maintain hope and healing?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of how I think about the specialty, is that, you know, when we counsel people or when we give a first diagnosis of glioblastoma, I'm pretty clear, or I try to be as clear as possible, that this is a terminal diagnosis. You know, these are the expectations. But just because you have a terminal diagnosis doesn't mean that we can't help treat it, that we can't maximize your quality of life, that we can't understand your goals. For example, is it to try to live another 2 years to see your daughter get married, for example, which I've had a few patients kind of mention that, you know, they have specific goals. And I think in dealing with these types of like serious illnesses and like these terminal diagnoses, I really see ourselves as a guide in treatment. And it's a privilege to be involved in end-of-life care. And you're almost, and I think it's blending the patient values with also like what we can offer in terms of what we think will be effective, and helping people make the decision about trying to live the rest of their lives, no matter how short it could be, in the best manner that they can be, with also maximizing their quality of life and also maximizing, you know, the quality of time that they spend. And sometimes people only see like the inpatient neuro-oncology, in which people are pretty sick. Our goal is really to try to keep people out of the hospital as much as possible, to be at home, to be with family, to be with friends, be with loved ones. And the way I see it is that, in terms of especially the parts in which we don't have the best treatments, that, you know, we are hopefully will figure out new treatments. We have lots of clinical trials, which are actually, you know, class one recommendations from the NCCN guidelines. But at the same time, we are in such a privileged position to help people navigate the end of life process.
What do you hope changes in the field of neuro-oncology within the next 10 years?
So I think that's part of it. While the field is kind of exciting right now, is that while I mentioned for glioblastoma, there's been no FDA approved treatment in the past 20 years. We just had one of our first positive clinical trials a few months ago for IDH mutant gliomas. So the medication vorasidenib, which is an IDH inhibitor, was found to basically increase progression-free survival and time to next therapy. And as we've understand these tumors more, we realize IDH is a big part of it. If a mutation is a driver of tumorigenesis, and if we have an IDH inhibitor, which we've developed, can we actually slow these tumors from growing and avoid radiation and chemotherapy? And the answer looks like probably yes. So we're still trying to figure out what's the best ways to really implement these medications in our practices. This will be hot topic for the next year plus. There's actually multiple trials about like combining these inhibitors with like immunotherapy, with like different types of other targeted therapies, with traditional chemotherapy. I think it's a very exciting time for us. And I think in the next 10 years, I really want to be able to say, hey, now I have a much better tool set or toolkit to offer patients. You know, we have medications A to, you know, C, and potentially even be able to avoid radiation, to avoid some therapies which may be toxic, especially for our younger patients. The IDH inhibitors, I think, are so attractive to all of us because the average diagnosis or age of like astrocytoma or like oligodendroglioma is like 30s, 40s. So, and the average life expectancy can be, you know, 15 years longer, 20 years. And if we can delay treatments that can potentially be toxic in a decade or so, then it's it. And while also hopefully improving overall life expectancy and quality of life, then I, you know, I think it's really exciting. So in the next 10 years, I'm hoping to offer a lot more to all of our patients.
I guess I can attest to this in some ways. Whenever I was going through residency in my training, you know, we just thought a glioblastoma was a glioblastoma was a glioblastoma. And I remember coming back and rotating on service and kind of this molecular biomarker kind of boom, if you will, kind of came out. And I had to go back over to our neuro-oncology department and just openly ask as a staff, teach me, please, because so much has changed in the last decade that now we know that there are so many different ways to treat potentially these tumors and that not every tumor is alike. And some of what the work that's being done in this field is pretty remarkable, even in the span of the last decade, I would say. So it's very cool for even us outside of neuro-oncology to see kind of how much we're honing in on really the molecular biomarkers for different types of tumors. And it's exciting for us too, in the whole field of neurology. So I don't want you to feel like just the 300 of you out there that are doing this work are excited. I think we're all excited for our field in general and for our patients that we share a lot of. So I'm also excited about this, and I appreciate all the work that you're doing.
Yeah, thanks. And it's also something we're looking at these, you know, different biomarkers, pathways. IDH is part of the Krebs cycle. So, you know, you thought you could forget about it after medical school. We look at the, today I ordered a MR spectroscopy looking at 2-hydroxy glutarate, which, you know, isn't, if alpha-ketoglutarate from the Krebs cycle goes into abnormal pathway, goes to that, which is an onco metabolite. So we are big fans of the Krebs cycle. And if students ask me like, oh, why are we studying this? This is exactly why.
You know, you had me until the last couple sentences, but I will keep that in mind the next time that I get asked about why do we need to learn this. I think that's a great use of it. So it's good to know it's still being put to use in some areas.
Gotta love the Krebs cycle. We want to switch gears and focus on your academic passion for health equity and writing. As mentioned previously, you are the editor of Neurology's DEI specialty section and have written numerous articulate pieces about increasing access to medicine, improving clinical trial diversity, and addressing the social determinants of health, especially related to cancer care. Many of your articles have notably been published in major news outlets, including the Boston Globe, NBC News, and the Washington Post, just to name a few. We would love to take a few moments to highlight a recent publication of yours titled Disparities in Neuro-Oncology, which was published in Current Neurology and Neuroscience Reports this year. In the article, you brilliantly discuss a major social determinant of health in neuro-oncology, as well as most of medicine, healthcare access and quality. Can you walk us through some of the major findings from this piece and how this piece has impacted the way that you provide care for neuro-oncology patients?
Yeah, thank you for that, Newport. It makes me to feel the work I do is much more than actually what it is. So for disparities in neuro-oncology, I kind of mentioned it before about as a subspecialist, like where does health equity fit in, and like what aspects can we be really like looking at? And, you know, as a neuro-oncologist, I noticed that, you know, for example, the chemotherapy that we give or like the outpatient medication. So like Zofran, for example, has lots of, like the copay is huge for Zofran for some insurances. And you kind of see different aspects. There's financial toxicity that develops because of the not only the copays involved, but the number of like appointments that you have to go to. If you're going for radiation for a glioblastoma, that's 30 fractions of radiation. That's 30 days you have to go in within a span of a couple months. And all of this leads to people losing their like jobs if they're the sole primary provider for a household. And all of these things kind of add up. There's medical bills add up. There's an alarming stat about the number, the percentage of people in the US who have medical debt. And these lead to other downstream effects, food insecurity, housing insecurity, and all these other conditions. So this paper was actually a review looking at different aspects of neuro-oncology. So primary brain tumors, brain mets, and trying to really compile where the disparities are. And we see it based on the social determinants of health and kind of a little bit, I think one of the major takeaways is really, like you mentioned, access to care, and actually even some of the biases that we exhibit in our healthcare system. So kind of some of the findings are that if you are a lower socioeconomic status, if you're from a rural population, if you're older, or if you're from a minority population, you're less likely to get radiation, you're less likely to be offered a full resection, you're more likely to have postoperative complications, and overall also likely to experience financial toxicity compared to other populations. So when you put all of that together, it's really alarming to see that the populations that are already marginalized are potentially being offered treatment that is not equitable actually throughout the spectrum. And the paper, I think, was really nice to work on it because it was one of the first comprehensive reviews on this topic in neuro-oncology. But I'll say from my perspective and almost everyone in the health equity field, while it's really important to describe these disparities, the steps that we should be making and the steps that we should be taking are to develop sustainable interventions that address these health disparities. So we're really hoping that as we, have finally described these problems and have identified them, that we look at the upstream factors and try to address them. And that's part of the work I do in kind of social determinants of health and looking at socioeconomic interventions.
Can you walk us through a little bit of the projects that you are currently doing as they are related to the social determinants of health?
Sure. Yeah, I can give you an example of a couple. So I work with the Immigrant Health and Cancer Disparity Service at MSK. And we have a couple programs. One is a food program in which the concept is pretty simple. If you are worried about food security, if where your next meal is coming from, you're probably not going to be worried about your cancer treatment. And so the concept's kind of simple. And we've provided food for people and actually for other cancers like breast cancer. We've seen that if you give someone food, provide them something either from a pantry or a delivery service, they are more likely to make it to their medical appointments because you're taking one of the stressors off of their life. So the work I'm doing right now is bringing that intervention to brain tumor patients, which have kind of usually historically been excluded from a lot of actually trials, which if you want to talk about a disparity though as well, that's something too. Another one is we have a network called the Integrated Cancer Care Access Network. The network is over 350 community organizations. We partner actually with different hospitals in New York, especially the public hospitals. And even though the IRB is out of MSK, we provide resources for patients who are not MSK patients, which I think is really important and really, it's really nice to see that we can, realize that the work for health equity and the path towards health equity rises out of a single institution and that, the whole job is to improve healthcare throughout the whole. So really quickly, some of the interventions that we kind of help with are housing support, transportation, financial support as well. So we kind of help with co-pays, like other things as well.
I'm curious to know, it seems like sometimes whenever we have a trial that comes out or we have a landmark paper that comes out that has to do with clinical care to our patients, if it's due to a drug or a treatment or something tangible like that, that it's almost immediately widespread effective. This is standard of care. This is put into the guidelines. Maybe it's just me and what I'm seeing with some of my patients, but this literature exists and these trials exist even within vascular neurology. But we don't see this as widely accepted, these health disparities and these kind of impactful programs. Do you see the same thing? And why don't we accept these as part of standard of care when we show how impactful they can be as readily as what we do with maybe a new medication?
Yeah, and I think we could probably spend 10 hours talking about this because it kind of actually opens up the question about priorities in U.S. healthcare and kind of healthcare as a whole. And without going into too much about, you know, incentivized or profit-based healthcare, it's kind of thinking about, you know, where is the like money? And so, for example, some of the treatments I give actually have a list price of $20,000 per infusion or $50,000. There's some treatments actually that like are, especially like our immunotherapy or like T-cell based treatments that can rise up to $500,000 CAR T treatment and all of this. Whereas an intervention such as giving people food costs us $600 per year, maybe. And which one, you know, potentially is cost effective or so. So I think part of it, what we realize is that we need to realign some of the incentives. So, and this is actually working through all parts of the healthcare system. So this is working with health insurance agencies to figure out, and actually a lot of them have been seeing that health disparities cost them money, because if someone has an illness earlier on, or if they have an adverse outcome, who's going to be paying for that? So health insurance companies are a big part of it, pharmaceutical companies, academic hospitals, the government, state, local policy, the patients, their patient advocacy communities, every single person and part of this healthcare chain is a part of trying to find solutions. And what we're trying to work at is, you know, having an intervention which may be, you know, simple, providing food for someone, but then showing the research that it improves adherence rates to radiation, or like you're maybe making your medical appointments by increases it by 20%. So then now it's the job of, you know, the research is that one part, but then it doesn't stop there. That's coming from, now we have the research, we have to go to the lawmakers, state, federal government, insurance companies, and make the case that this is an intervention that helps save lives. This is an intervention that increases quality of life, and it's cost effective. We should be covering this. And I think, you know, medicine in general, especially for like physicians, we've always had the mindset that medicine is at the bedside. We see a patient and that's it, and we go home. But looking into all these social factors that go a part of it, there's always a stat that goes around, which is pretty alarming or pretty eye-raising, when 80% of the modifiable contributors to health outcomes are due to the social determinants of health. So this is like throughout someone's lifespan. And if they have a stroke at age 47, like earlier than expected, what were the conditions that like played into that? Was it, you know, access to care? Was it ability to have a healthy diet? Was it the insurance status, the kind of job or occupational hazards? And we realize that all of these other social factors, which traditionally aren't thought in a medical setting, have so much importance in healthcare. In terms of like a program, like, you know, giving food to someone, or like addressing some of these social determinants of health. Traditionally, there has not been an economic argument for it. I think there actually is, because it saves people money and people are realizing that now. But it's just cost effective if we show the research and we show that even besides medications or so, that we can have a similar or even different impact and a synergistic impact with some of the other treatments. Then, you know, we just need to make our case at both at the like legislature as well as throughout our entire industry.
Yeah, thanks for kind of chatting about that a little bit. And it's always that downstream effect that's really hard to show tangibly to these people that just want to see this impactful thing, you know, in the acute phase, and this is why we should do this. But I completely agree with you. And the only other thing that I wanted to personally ask you about was the effect on caregivers. And I'm sure that you see this a lot in your practice. And oftentimes we focus a lot on the patients, but this also affects, again, from a financial standpoint, from a wellness standpoint, caregivers suffer right along with our patients. And I wonder if there are some things that we can do from an equity standpoint that would also focus on the caregiver team around the patient, and how, you know, some of these things, or if we could show how impactful a medical diagnosis or a surgical diagnosis or a kind of just something that is unplanned for can affect the caregivers also. I know that sometimes whenever I recognize some caregiver burnout in my own practice, I pause and I ask, how are you doing, to the caregiver, whoever that may be. And unfortunately, I see patients that are referred in from all over and they've seen multiple people. And sometimes I'm told this is the first time that anyone has asked me anything about me. And I've lost my job and I had to take early retirement. And we, you know, just we sold our house. We had to do this. We had to do that. And so do you see any work or movement that's being done? Or do you encounter this on a daily basis with how this is also affecting the families and the caregivers of people of your patients?
Yeah, no, that is such an important part, Blake. And I think that, the perfect example, which you mentioned, like the financial toxicity part of it, in which treatment for one person doesn't affect just that one person, and the amount of money or the amount of debt they have to incur affects the caregivers, affects the entire family, has downstream effects all throughout like that person's extended family. And when you look at like the astronomical amounts of medical debt in our country, it's just, yeah, you know, it's just really mind-blowing. It really is an underappreciated fact or underappreciated aspect of medicine about how all of this affects caregivers. And in even mentioning the financial part, like the time toxicity, how much time do people spend taking people to appointments? How much time do they spend in waiting rooms, advocating, going to the pharmacy, picking up all of this? And I will say it's also like, as the equity piece, it affects people who have less resources more. So the more marginalized you are, the more that you have to use your own time, or you're not able to hire someone, or that you're not able to, maybe hire like a taxi to go back and forth between an appointment, but you have to take the bus, takes 2 hours. And all of that, I think, is just an underappreciated part of medicine and how it affects the caregivers. So we do a little bit of work with that. And I think in oncology, it's been, especially like given how serious the illnesses are, there's been at least some focus in the past years about really involving patient family members and caregivers. We have a couple of programs that are just actually for caregivers of families, but there can be so much more that we can work for. And I think this is all part of the aspect of moving towards a much more kind of treating the entire person, or treating the entire patient. And that includes their family, includes all the other aspects which are really affected by it.
Neubra, this is always one of my favorite parts of doing this, because Josh and I probably on paper look very different from what we do day in and day out, but I think back to the core of who we are as medical professionals, physicians, and neurologists, I think we have a lot of similarities, and we're all cut from a very similar cloth, which is one of the reasons why I love talking to other neurologists and other people in our field so much. So thanks again for entertaining all my questions today.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to continue the conversation too.
Well, as we wrap up this beautiful hour that we spent together, there's a few remaining tasks that we have to get done, Josh. One of them is having you provide us with a 1-minute elevator pitch for the subspecialty of neuro-oncology.
All right, one minute. It's going to be hard to pack all that into 1 minute. All right, I'll start. Neuro-oncology is an amazing blend of clinical patient care, along with research, scientific advancement, and the opportunity to really advance patient care. It's an amazing blend, because you get to see patients and you really get to have the privilege of navigating through very serious illness, very serious conversations, talking with family members, maintaining such a great connection even after a patient is kind of may pass away or discharged from clinic. And it's a field in which you get to really work with so many really smart people. So the multidisciplinary aspect of it is amazing. Talking to the neurosurgeons who have different fields and specialty, the radiation oncologist, even going down to neuropath and seeing some of the slides, it's actually a really good reminder of like why we actually got into medicine in the first place. The advances are really important. You probably can't see me on the podcast, but I am ready to jump out of my seat when I talk about IDH inhibitors, just because it's great to hear like an advancement in our field and where we can really apply this in an appropriate way. So sum up Great clinical care, great research, great collaboration, but really most importantly, it's the patients, just the patient population we take care of is, they are 100% so great. And it really is a privilege and I'm honored to be taking care of these people.
That was just beautifully said. And I think our audience is obviously going to appreciate the excitement that you have for the Krebs cycle, Josh. I don't think I'm pretty sure they'll be able to tell. So the last thing that we wanted to do before we conclude this interview with you is ask you about your no-brainers. And these are going to be 5 rapid fire questions that you can respond to with 1 word or 1 sentence maximum. So are you ready for your no-brainers?
Sure. Lots of pressure, but yes, sure.
You're going to do great. Favorite part of this conversation?
I think the discussion about health equity and kind of the other aspects that we just talked about were about family members, caregivers, and other underappreciated populations that we serve.
Best place to get a slice of New York pizza?
Oh man, you're gearing me up to get like comments or someone to like yell at me. I will say my personal favorite is Joe's on Bleecker. So yeah, Joe's Pizza, Bleecker Street.
Great. What was the last movie you watched?
I have to think about that. Was that actually a movie? All right, a first official or like the real movie, I watched John Wick 4.
Was it good?
It was very long. So it was good, but it was like 3 hours long. It probably could have been cut by like 45 minutes or an hour.
Fair. What advice would you have for neurology residents or neurology hopefuls who are interested in health equity?
We need you. one sentence about it is the field is looking for people. We know it's important, and neurology is the perfect place because the brain and the nervous system affects every single person, and there are so many ways in which we can affect change through health equity.
And the last question we have, what are you most proud of?
I think I'm most proud of my marriage. So my wife and I, we've known each other since high school. So I'll say that every day it's also a privilege to wake up and be a part of a relationship with her. So that's what I'm most proud of. I should have her listen to this so that she could actually be nice to me. I'm kidding.
We'll make sure that we send her the link. In this episode, we discussed the subspecialty of neuro-oncology and the importance of advancing health equity in cancer care. We want to thank our phenomenal guest, Dr. Joshua Badu, and you, our neurophilia community, for listening to the full episode. If you enjoyed it, please leave us a review, share it with a friend and colleague, and follow us at Neurophilia Pod for updates on future episodes. See you next time!